Well, I got those kids in shape. Guess whose turn it is now? You're going to have a lot of fun. Trust me.
Major production support for Backstory is provided by the National Endowment for the Humanities and by the University of Virginia.
From the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, this is Backstory with the American History Guys.
Hey there, welcome. I'm Brian Ballow, 20th Century Guy, and I'm here with Ed Ayers,
the 19th Century Guy,
and Peter Onuf's with us.
18th century guy.
Okay, so we decided a while back that we wanted to do a show about bodies, like the physical body. It's summertime. People are going to the beach. They're watching these gorgeous Olympians on television. And all that stuff got us thinking, I wonder how Americans thought about their bodies a long time ago. What did it take to look good back in the day?
Yeah, to find out, we called Eddie Portnoy.
Hi, I'm Eddie Portnoy. I teach Jewish literature and Yiddish language at Rutgers University.
And Eddie kind of backed into some research on body image. One of the first things we talked about was how, in the early 1800s, people started thinking that maybe the body wasn't just a body. Maybe the way they were shaped said something about what kind of person they were.
Phrenology is a pseudoscience that was created in the early 19th century. That holds that a person's character can be determined by reading the bumps on their head.
Now, some of you are probably familiar with phrenology, but just in case, here's a quick overview. The first phrenologist is actually a German doctor, Franz Josef Gall. In 1819, he divided the skull into 27 different sections.
Kind of an architecture of the human head.
And by feeling the bumps on each one of these sections, you can learn something about a person's character.
So it could determine something like criminality or future intelligence, things like that.
And this is not just a fringe science. In 1846, Walt Whitman observed that phrenology had crossed over into the mainstream.
Breasting the waves of detraction as a ship dashes sea waves, phrenology must now be confessed by all men who have open eyes, has at last gained a position, and a firm one, among the sciences.
In the wake of phrenology's rise as a prominent science, in 1848, a very interesting book is published in London.
By a man by the name of Eden Warwick, which is allegedly the pseudonym of Georges Jabet. And the book is titled Nasology.
Nasology?
Yeah, Peter, nasology.
Nasology is a 19th century pseudoscience which holds that a person's character can be read via the shape of their nose.
And nasology really maps onto the way people are thinking about the body at the time. It really fits in with phrenology. But Warwick does write about one key difference. While phrenology claims it's the skull, in other words, the body that determines the character,
nasology completely upends that idea by claiming that it's the mind that creates the shape of the nose. If you become more intelligent, your nose will actually change.
We're going to talk about that connection between our bodies and our character, because throughout American history, we've had different ideas of what the perfect body looked like. And we've also had different ideas about how to get that perfect body.
From nose jobs to dieting to getting a tan, we're going to look at ourselves very closely this hour. And we'll try to figure out why and how, over time, Americans have strived for certain physical ideals.
Jumping back to nasology, when Warwick wrote this book, he broke down all noses into six categories, six different types of noses.
Number one is the Roman nose, which is aquiline and convex.
So it's hooked, like an eagle's beak.
It's an indicator of great decision, considerable energy, firmness, absence of refinement, and disregard for the bienséance of life.
Wait, bienséance, is that like a hip-hop artist?
This is a French term that's thrown in there. It's sort of the enjoyment of life.
Enjoyment of life, good.
The second category is the Greek category. That's a straight nose. It indicates refinement of character, love for the fine arts and belles lettres, astuteness, craft, and a preference for indirect action. If it's not obvious, I'm quoting directly from the book. If the Greek nose is slightly distended at the end, it indicates the most useful and intellectual of characters and is the highest and most beautiful form which the organ can assume. The third category is the cogitative or the wide nostril nose. This indicates a cogitative mind having strong powers of thought and given to serious thought and meditation. The fourth category is the Jewish or hawk nose, and it is very convex. It indicates considerable shrewdness in worldly matter, a deep insight into character, and facility of turning that insight into profitable account. It's also known as the commercial nose. While named for the Jews, it is not exclusive to them, nor is it confined to them. So it may be that you're not Jewish, but you happen to have this type of nose.
Right.
Which also indicates that you are good at business. Categories 5 and 6, according to Warwick, are the snub nose and the celestial nose. And these are indicative of natural weakness, mean, disagreeable dispositions with petty insolence, poverty of character. Celestial has a slightly greater length than the snub, which causes the bearer to have at least a share of fox-like common sense. A snub nose is considered to be proof of the degeneracy of the human race. That is Warwick's taxonomy.
Let me just ask this. Eden Warwick, how did he intend this? Are you able to discern whether he intended this to be a joke or intended it to be serious?
My feeling is that he intended it to be a kind of satire on phrenology, sort of a send-up of it, which is somewhat strange because it's a 250-page joke, if you look at it that way.
It is with considerable distaste and reluctance that we approach the latter divisions of our classification. We wish we had never undertaken to write of these noses, that after contemplating the powerful Roman nose or the refined and elegant Greek nose, it must descend to the imbecile inanity of the snub.
Eddie says that when nasology was first published in London in 1848, nobody took it very seriously. But 4 years later, the book was republished again in England, and it really took off. Because despite the differences, phrenologists adopted it as one of their sciences. The book and various knockoff versions made their way to the United States, and over the next 50 years, nasology became a very big deal.
You have articles in magazines like the Saturday Evening Post, in Harper's Bazaar, in the New York Times, Washington Post, in almost any American newspaper, you'll find some article at some point during the late 19th century on this topic.
And these were serious articles. These were not tongue-in-cheek. Nasology somehow had made it into the mainstream of as a subset of phrenology?
Yeah.
Is that the right way to put it?
Yeah, basically. For the most part, it's taken seriously. And what's interesting about it is the way in which it influenced real medicine and real doctors. The first doctor known to have performed a rhinoplasty in the United States was a man by the name of John Rowe. And he wrote an article in, I believe, 1887 in a medical journal describing what he had done, and he had performed an operation on a pug nose or a snub nose that, according to Warwick, it's the least desirable kind of nose. Rowe, in his article, cites Warwick's taxonomy of noses, all of these different classes, the Roman, the Greek, the Jewish.
What do you think was going on in the culture or in the politics of the time, if you will, that helped turn a book that probably was intended as a satire of the pseudoscience of phrenology into, kind of a growth industry?
Well, I think there are a variety of factors here. In the popular press, racial caricatures were very common. So throughout the 19th and early 20th centuries, in magazines and newspapers, you can find caricatures of all kinds of different racial and national types, and the nature of caricatures to distort reality, but nonetheless retain a semblance of what the person realistically looks like. So, a caricature of a Jew, for example, would often have an absolutely enormous nose. a caricature of an Irish person would have this snub nose. And for people who had something that looked similar, you know, to these noses, it was undoubtedly irritating to have to see it. I mean, it's not something that exists in our popular culture anymore.
Right.
But 100 years ago, it was something that was very common.
Eddie Portnoy is a professor of Jewish studies at Rutgers University.
You know, what's interesting, Brian, is that an idea that begins in the 1840s that your nose will be shaped by your character. By the 1880s, they have a different idea, that your nose will be shaped by surgery. You know,
right.
And it's yeah, right. Very much a modern idea. Why wait for your character to shape your nose when a doctor can do it for you?
And I think, too, it's easy to laugh at all this stuff, and we have been laughing. It's funny. But I think this, what this seems like, pseudoscience, Eddie called it pseudoscience, nasology and phrenology, it's all, I think, an understandable effort to use, well, scientific method and a scientific language to try to delve the depths of what we call now psychology. It's important information to have. How are you going to figure out who's up to what? I mean, Ed, this is the great century of the confidence man, a real anxiety about getting beneath surface. And so one way to get beneath surface is to insist that surface actually tells you about something that's below. It's at least a screening device, or you might say a form of profiling.
And in many ways, we're not so far from it today. In many ways, we've gone back to a fixation on the body as a marker of character with our fixation on fitness. So you'll know what kind of person a person is by whether or not they've taken care of their bodies or not, what foods they put into it, how much they exercise. So we kind of sneer at this kind of idea, but we also now take it for granted that the way you treat your body tells you about what kind of person is inside. We're talking today about the history of Americans' efforts to achieve a more perfect body. We looked at nasology, the idea that a person's nose might be a key to his or her character. It was an idea that struck a chord in the middle of the 19th century, when American culture was full of questions about the connection between inner and outer beauty, between the ideal body and the ideal character.
It wasn't simply a matter of vanity. There was also a civic dimension to this new obsession with body image. This was a time when almost everything was in flux, and the question of who would or wouldn't have a political voice was very much a live one. We're going to hear now about another way in which people's physical bodies were drawn into this debate.
It all began with a little pamphlet called A Letter on Corpulence, written in 1863 by a British undertaker named William Banting. Now, Banting was overweight, and it had become a real problem for him.
He describes himself in his pamphlet, and he says that he was no longer able to climb stairs. He had to climb stairs backwards to make it up there, and he could no longer tie his shoes.
This is Katharina Vester, an historian at American University. She told me that the letter on corpulence documented Banting's own attempts to lose weight. It promised that if others followed the same program, they too could shed the pounds. The pamphlet was wildly popular on both sides of the Atlantic, so much so that by the late 1860s, dieting was being referred to in American newspapers simply as Banting. And what did this Banting regime look like? Katharina Vester told me all about it.
It is quite meat-heavy, and it also suggests that people who want to lose weight should row a lot or smoke a lot or drink a lot of alcohol. So it's not exactly how
No, slow down. This is a diet that recommends smoking and drinking?
Right. It suggests alcohol for every meal.
So obviously this is pitched toward men.
Exactly. And we can see that diet advice is also placed mostly in publications for men, like do-it-yourself magazines, such as Manufacturer and Builder, between advertisements for scroll saws or articles on floor matting. They now start to have diet recommendations, too, for their readers.
Now, why would American men get all excited about what a British undertaker has to tell them about being fat?
Well, it fit into earlier American thought in many ways. Yeah, so we have already writings by Emerson, who suggests that masculinity is closely connected to self-control, which also fits into Puritan ideas of bodily control. So this is all basically there already. And then when it hits the United States in the 1860s, we have a rising middle class that strives to participate in political power.
Mm-hmm.
And basically they get the tool because they are kept out of many ways to decide the nation's fate by being told that they are vulgar, non-educated, not sophisticated enough. And dieting is one way in which they can demonstrate that they can control their urges and that they're ready to rule.
So they're demonstrating that they have the kind of self-control that elites traditionally exercise. Is that the point?
Exactly. And it's interesting that in the middle of the 19th century, and it's earlier in Europe, that overweight is now associated with greed and corruption.
Mm.
And we see that there's an increased fear that American society, and especially American men ruling American society, become too weak, too soft, too feminine. And this has a number of different causes. So one of the most prominent ones is that men start to work sedentary jobs, desk jobs, where they no longer work out and don't do the traditional professions that men engaged in before, like trades. So there is the fear that this is not only infecting American masculinity, but American society in general, that American society will lose power because its men are no longer as masculine as they used to be.
I want to stop the tape here for a second because, as you may have noticed, the story so far is a little one-sided. What, you may be wondering, did dieting advice for women look like around this time? Basically, the advice was this: don't do it. Listen to how Harper's Bazaar described the effects of weight loss by women in 1896.
The body and the face lose their roundness. The eyes become sunken. The cheeks fall in. The lips are drawn. The skin acquires the hue and hardness of parchment. While at the same time lines and wrinkles multiply, the chest becomes hollow and the waist angular.
It's interesting to see that men start dieting and women start to become plumper and plumper. There are actually beauty manuals that are called things like How to Be Plump.
And why is that so desirable or attractive? Why does plumpness have a vogue in this period?
Well, so it's the maternal body is considered being very attractive. The soft body, the body that presents the most difference to the male body, seems to be sexually more desirable. So we have, at the end of the century, we have sex goddesses like Lillian Russell, who weighed presumably something like 200 pounds.
Wow.
So it's really the very plump woman is the ideal of the time.
You can see in this context that women are supposed to look fertile. They suggest sexuality, motherhood, maternal body, and so forth. In this context, it's not surprising that some women might take exception.
Exactly. So the first diet advice for women that we can find is actually written by women's rights activists and by female doctors. So we have writers like Anna Kingsford, who is a doctor in Great Britain and a women's rights activist, who in 1886 writes the first diet for women. These early rights activists associated the slender, healthy female body with equality, strength, and liberty. Yeah, so they argued that if women were able to show that they could control their bodies in the same way that white middle-class men were able to control their bodies, that they could demonstrate that they're rational beings fit to determine the fate of the nation. So there is the idea that this would help their cause to claim suffrage. So often we hear that women has diet as a form of oppression, as a way to divert them from
right.
their political interests. But my research showed that actually women started dieting as a means of liberation, to embody a new type of woman who can participate in American policies.
In the context of women's rights, this is empowering to mimic or follow the example of men and gain control over your body. What is its implication for race and class?
Yeah, that's more problematic because white middle-class women who made the claim that they would be able to also control their bodies often made at the same time the claim that immigrant women, women of color, working class women are not able to control their bodies. So basically, it's not that they now ask for an inclusion of everybody into civic power, but actually they suggest that they should be included, but others should be excluded. So we can see, for instance, in cooking manuals or household manuals of the time written by best-selling authors like Marion Harland, that she suggests that her white middle-class readers should exercise regularly. But at the same time, she says that Bridgets and Gretchens, which are the code words for Irish and German maids and cooks, that they are too lazy to exercise and that they are overweight because of that. And there's implicitly the argument that because they are not able to control their bodies, they are also not able to be American citizens yet.
Katerina Vester is an assistant professor of history at American University.
They don't want skinny woman, don't they?
We've been talking about the history of body image in America. So far, we've focused on how people have tried to alter their own bodies. But, you know, I want to bring us into the 20th century, because that's when the federal government got into the game. And that story begins in the years after World War II. In the war's first year, 50% of all the men drafted actually were rejected for service. Some for things like flat feet or bad eyesight, others because of illness, both mental and physical. But a few of those men who were rejected got slapped down because of the very shape of their bodies.
Rejection specifically for weight, for example, actually made up only 60 to 70,000 rejected men, which is very few. It's about 2% at the time.
This is Rachel Moran, an historian at Penn State and Miller Center National Fellow.
It's a small reason for rejection, but it becomes huge in the national imagination.
So right after World War II, this very famous doctor,
Dr. Hans Krauss,
puts together a study. He wants to know how fit American kids are compared to kids in other countries. So he takes a few thousand American kids and a few thousand European kids
and asks them all to do toe touches and things like that. In the end, he determines that American children are incredibly unfit compared to their European competitors, and that this fitness is what he calls a menace to our security.
So Dr. Krauss is a really big deal doctor at the time. People call him the father of sports medicine, and word of his study gets back to President Eisenhower, who's already plugged into the fitness world.
Eisenhower was actually a bit of a fitness nut. He would evangelize about low-carb diets. And at one point in the White House, he actually held this playful Biggest Loser contest with a couple of his friends where they owed him money if they didn't lose weight fast enough.
And after reading Krauss's study in 1955, Eisenhower tries to hold a conference to figure out just how to get American kids more fit.
They actually have to put their conference off because Eisenhower has his heart attack.
Minor setback there. They reschedule and hold the conference the next year. And it's at this conference that they establish the President's Council on Youth Fitness. It later became the President's Council on Physical Fitness, and many other names followed. But this is the beginning of the Cold War. And so the idea of the government trying to shape people's bodies, well, it feels a little problematic, a little like communism.
It's images of Russian calisthenics being done by force that makes it so important that American calisthenics are done by choice.
And guys, who do you turn to when you want to persuade people to voluntarily choose things themselves? Of course, you turn to Madison Avenue. The President's Council teams up with the Advertising Council. These are the folks who brought you Smokey the Bear, McGruff the Crime Dog, etc., etc. And Madison Avenue delivers. They produce thousands of ads, print, TV, radio, all to convince kids that physical fitness is cool.
There are some great ones that really connect American anxiety about the Cold War with sort of anxiety about fitness. So there's a big focus on astronauts. For instance, astronauts being a great Cold War dream job for American boys. So if Captain Jim Lovell of Apollo 13 fame is standing in front of a rocket and says, any kid who wants my job will have to be in pretty good shape.
You know, we're pretty well motivated to keep in shape. I'll tell you where it gets tough, though. When you're on the road. But when you know that staying in shape and keeping healthy can make the big difference to you in the program, you do it.
If you're an American boy in Cold War culture, that's going to be a pretty appealing message.
The Fitness Council also struck gold with a musical hit, the Chicken Fat song.
Chicken Fat is a song that was composed by Meredith Willson and actually sung by Robert Preston, both of whom were Broadway stars at the time. And it's prepared in 1962, specifically for Kennedy's President's Council on Physical Fitness. And the song's about 6.5 minutes long, and it's a calisthenics song. So essentially, it's the kind of record that your school would put on the PA system, or perhaps your classroom teacher would play. And the song would admonish you to touch your toes, to do sit-ups, in a sort of 6.5 minute rhythmic style.
Push up every morning, 10 times push up, starting low. Once more on the rise, nuts to the flabby guys. Go, you chicken fat, go away. Go, you chicken fat, go.
And in fact, the song managed to sell over 100,000 records its first year.
As we were finishing the interview, I had sort of a therapy moment where I confessed to Rachel, talked to her about the traumatizing experience in elementary school when we were all tested for the number of pull-ups that we could do.
Oh.
For me, the number was, yes, zero. Rachel, are Eisenhower and Kennedy's physical fitness programs to blame for that, or did I just have a sadistic gym teacher?
Oh, no, you definitely get to put your blame, actually, in this case, on Lyndon Johnson.
One of my favorite presidents. Who knew?
Well, in 1966, very much as part of the President's Council on Physical Fitness, it's his administration that's going to issue the President's Award for Physical Fitness. So while schools were in no way forced to institute these programs, essentially programming for the President's Award is going to spread slowly nationwide. Ooh. And that includes running the mile and the flexibility tests and, yes, the pull-ups.
Oh, my God.
So I tell my students that the reason they have to run the mile in high school is because we were afraid of communists. I think it's good. I think it's good to know.
Right. Don't look back. They might be gaining on you. What do you think the lasting effects of these programs that were started in the late 50s and the early 60s are today?
I think that the most interesting effects might be the handicap it's placed on government programs that might actually address fitness issues. Because fitness was set up at this Cold War moment with this extreme emphasis on limited government and individual freedoms, there's a real sense that everything has to be done through advertising. Everything has to be done by asking schools to voluntarily take up government ideas. And in the end, that means that the entire program comes off almost as a joke to some people. Mm-hmm. When I mention it. It doesn't seem like even a real function of the government. What is this President's Council? And I think it's made it very difficult for the council to do anything meaningful in the long run because it's already set up as a sort of shell of an agency. And I Right. think that that also has effects for Michelle Obama's Let's Move, and that I think the expectations for what government fitness and nutrition programs might do is already set.
When you feel stressed,
Rachel Moran is an historian at Penn State University and a Miller Center National Fellow.
Fitness is feeling great.
Today, we're talking about body image in American history. We've been looking at how Americans have thought about their noses, dieting, even physical fitness. And now, we're going to take some listener questions.
Hey guys, gather around. We got a phone call from Virginia Beach. It's Candace. Candace, welcome to Backstory.
Thanks, Brad. How are you?
Good.
So, I'm Chinese, and whenever I go over to China, I get a lot of heat from my family because I'm usually a lot tanner than everyone else. And to them, because I'm so tan, it makes it seem like I'm just outside a lot. And to them, that means that I'm not inside studying or working and being successful. And I'm just wondering, do you see that in American history where, you know, people who are tanner are seen a little differently status-wise?
Yeah.
Like that?
Candace, you ask a great question, and that is, how do people read each other's bodies according to where they're exposed? And the simple answer to that, and I'll throw this out for all centuries, is that people who are tanned are out there working.
Oh, Peter, you have such an 18th century view of the world. Because here in the 20th century and the 21st century, to have a tan in our consumption-oriented, leisure-oriented society doesn't mean you're out there working hard. It means you're at the beach, or it means you're skiing.
Mm-hmm. Now, Candace, your friends would really feel at home in my century, the 19th century, where we were doing things right. And there, the greatest mark of status would have been just how pale you could get, especially
right.
if you were a woman. And the whole idea of the bonnets and all the other coverings was to basically cover as much of the body as possible at all times. And a large part of that was to protect yourself from when you were outdoors, precisely because you did not want to be known as someone who ever had to toil outside. And of course, this is where you come up with one of the great pejoratives in American culture, redneck. That is a direct reflection of working outdoors in the sun with your head bowed, so that your neck became red from exposure to the sun. So what do you tell your friends and your family when you go over there? Do you say, oh, you just don't understand when your centrally developed capitalism actually catches up with ours? You'll understand that this is a mark of having succeeded so well that you have plenty of discretionary time in order to play outside.
I haven't quite made that argument yet.
But that's what it is. If you're pale now, it suggests that you're trapped in some job where you don't control your own time and you cannot get outside for your fair share of fresh air and sunshine. Whereas if you're a
right.
hedge fund manager or a university president, say, you can just do whatever you want to do whenever you want to do it. And that involves getting outside.
Right.
Okay, Candace, you just stay outside and be proud, okay?
Okay.
All right, Candace, thanks a lot for your call.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So, Brian, I'm going to have to admit, this must be something that happens in the 20th century. Certainly, when I hand the ball off to you at 1900, we're all about parasols and covering. But sometime in the... Well, you tell me, when does it happen that the tan becomes a sign of vitality and youth?
Well, you're right, Ed, in that you can't see a tan if you're entirely covered up. And even when people go to the beach at the beginning of the 20th century, they're pretty covered up. I absolutely love the mechanism from your period, Ed, that provides a little hut that people get into. And they are then backed into, first by a horse and then mechanically, they're backed into the ocean so that when they get out in the ocean, they're totally immersed so that they will not be seen at all, just to underscore how dressed up people were. You might be surprised to learn how late into my century it is that it's, you know, still illegal for a guy to take a shirt off. It was the 30s that they started even making swimsuits for guys where you could remove the shirt. And it wasn't really until the 1940s that you could be pretty confident that taking your shirt off, if you were a guy, wasn't going to get you arrested. Now, I get arrested at even the thought of taking my shirt off.
That's an arresting thought, I would have to admit.
So, Brian, when Marlon Brando screams, "Stella, Stella," and he's wearing that very suggestive undershirt, that's a lot racier than we think now, right?
It is. And, Peter, once again, you've got your finger on the pulse of the 20th century, because probably what started the trend of guys taking their shirts off in the 30s was that iconic picture of Tarzan the Ape Man, Johnny Weissmuller, wow, star swimmer, with his shirt off in the movies. And that's really what changed this whole trend.
Did he have a tan?
It was black and white, so it was really hard for me to tell.
Sunshine, go away today. I don't feel much like dancing.
If you're just tuning in, this is Backstory, and we're talking about the history of American body image. We're taking questions from our listeners.
We have a call from Tunisia, from Tunis. It's Lenore. Lenore, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And today's show is about body image.
Yeah, well, the topic's been really interesting to me, and it made me think about how a lot of times part of the standard of beauty of the era has been determined by how people have either adhered to gender norms or maybe gone against them and broken them. And I'm just sort of wondering, like, why, for example, why in the Victorian period did people expect women to grow their hair out and wear these hourglass corsets that really emphasized their feminine shape, and, you know, versus in the 1920s when fashions were favoring the very slim, more, I guess, masculine figured women, and they cut off their hair? Or even in the 1970s when, you know, men grew their hair out in the counterculture, and that was sort of a political statement as well. So I guess the question is just, how have perceptions of beauty been influenced by how people adhere to or break gender norms, and whatever those gender norms might be in the era?
Well, you know, we tend to think of the 19th century as a time that is sort of unified by what we might think of as Victorian ideals. But the 19th century saw as many changes as the 20th century has in the ideal of womanhood. And I think it's fair to say that women's styles and fashioning and self-fashioning and projection is much more changeable than men's. Because in the 19th century, you go from quite sheer sort of displays of the female form in the early 19th century to something that's more modest, and then to something that's almost obscenely exaggerated with hoops and corsets and bustles. You know, we're basically sort of really exaggerating the female derriere. And then in the second half of the 19th century, all that seems hopelessly outdated, and they begin moving to bloomers as a sign of liberation, because bloomers would allow you not to worry about covering up your legs so much, because they're covered up closer to your body with a sort of pants. So over those 100 years, you see real changes. It doesn't move toward greater exposure. I mean, it doesn't seem to be pointing necessarily toward the 20th century, because the cult of womanhood in the 1890s is the Gibson girl, who is still very fully draped and
robust.
She's robust, but she does start playing tennis. She does start playing golf. And the clothing, even though you have these very full skirts, are allowing you to ride bicycles, which is the great controversy. Could a lady ride a bicycle without compromising herself? So what you see across the 19th century is not just a static covering, but rather different kinds of projection of what the meaning of womanhood might be.
You mentioned bloomers covering the body, but allowing more freedom of movement. And I've actually seen a lot of pants here in Tunisia that are very full but gathered at the cuff, and I'm wondering now if that's sort of an attempt at the modesty of a skirt and the femininity of a skirt, but with more freedom of movement, revealing the ankles.
Then what happens in the 20th century, Brian?
Well, the trend in the 20th century is that periods that we tend to associate with women asserting their rights as citizens tend to veer towards what in the 70s we called unisex.
Yeah.
So certainly women were very active politically in asserting their right to vote during the 1920s, and that's the era of the flapper, where really women's bodies, still pretty covered, although hemlines go up, become somewhat formless. There's a de-emphasis on the bosom. And, of course, the 1970s, women stopped wearing bras. Again, the bosom was de-emphasized. And really, the whole idea behind unisex clothing was that women and men wore quite literally the same clothing. I mean, that didn't last very long because that cut down on sales for lots of clothing manufacturers.
We've become very self-conscious about fashion in the modern period. We think of the statements that we're making maybe in a way that they didn't back in the 18th century. So you're living in exciting times, Lenore, in an exciting place. Thanks very much for calling us.
Thank you, Lenore.
Yeah, I was so happy to be able to hear your opinion about all this. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
We're going to end our show today with a look at a slightly different part of the body, the missing part. Amputation had been around for a long time, but it was not until the American Civil War, when chloroform was first used as an anesthetic, that the operation became commonplace. 40,000 Northerners, 20,000 Southerners returned home as amputees. And with the loss of limbs came a crisis of manliness. How could these men support their families without the use of their natural arms and legs? Would their women still love them? Were they still complete men, even if they had parts of their body missing? In the years during the Civil War, there emerged a new genre of poems and songs, stories and pictures, all of which gave voice to this anxiety. Here's an example from an 1862 poem. It's written from the perspective of a soldier riding home to his fiancée to report that he's lost an arm in battle.
But I've something else, dear Mary, to say, and I'd say it if it cost me my life. I've thought of it well. There's no other way. You're released from your promise to be my wife. You'll think me foolish at first. Then you'll think of the loose, armless coat sleeve at my side, and your proud and sensitive heart will shrink from the thought of being a cripple's bride.
This image of an empty sleeve figured centrally in many other works of art from the 1860s. Historian Megan Kate Nelson writes about this theme in her book called Ruin Nation, Destruction and the American Civil War. She told me what the empty sleeve represented.
What it represented was the soldier's bravery and his patriotism, and also his manliness, that he had that sort of emptiness of his sleeve, and most often the sleeve was kind of pinned up, right? So it was a coat that was made for a man with an arm, but the arm was no longer there. And so you see what he had been and then what he is now. And that transition was enabled by all of these very positive virtues that the soldier had demonstrated on the field of battle. And so empty sleeve literature was really this positive narrative of wounding in the war and also of amputation, that this man had acquitted himself so well on the battlefield and had given his limb for the country and had survived to tell the tale. And another important component of this was that the soldier then would go on to marry his sweetheart, usually a sweetheart he had had and had been courting before the war, before his wounding, when he was a whole man. He would marry her and have children and be able to work and sort of be fully reintegrated into American culture.
And you have a powerful picture in your book of a double amputee with his wife and his numerous children. And she's holding the ball that apparently wounded him. Is that right?
Yes. That photograph is amazing. I think it's so amazing they brought the ordnance in as part of the family. But yes, and this idea, because there was a lot of concern and anxiety that amputees would not be able to procreate. They would not be able to fulfill the sort of gender role as a husband and a father. And so there were many visual images of soldiers with young children kind of communicating the point that they could still have children and contribute to the future of the nation, just as they had, you know, contributed their limb to the cause.
So were there differences in the way that black soldiers and white soldiers experienced these losses?
The issue of black veterans and amputees is a really interesting one, because in many ways, the empty sleeve literature and the conversation surrounding African-American soldiers and their injuries was very similar to the conversation about white soldiers. And there's a very famous series of paintings called A Bit of War History by Thomas Waterman Wood. You know, it's three different images that track the movement of the fugitive slave to the black soldier to the veteran. And in that final image of the veteran, the black soldier is an amputee. And there's a very positive spin, I think, in that image that goes along with the empty sleeve literature themes. But this was really complicated because before the war and during the war as well, you know, black bodies meant something very different in American culture than white bodies. And the visual rhetoric and also the written rhetoric about slavery really focused on damage to black bodies in slavery, usually through the medium of the whip. So their war story sort of continued their kind of giving of their own bodies to this larger purpose. So the narrative was more complicated with them, although it did share many of the same kinds of ideas and images as with the bodies of wounded white soldiers.
Megan Kate Nelson is a lecturer at Harvard University. Her new book is called Ruined Nation, Destruction and the American Civil War.
He's a twistable, turnable, squeezable, pullable, stretchable, foldable man.
That's going to do it for us today. If you've been listening to Backstory while jogging 6 miles per hour on a treadmill, you've burned about 750 calories this episode. Congratulations.
For more on the history of American bodies, check out our website, backstoryradio.org. You can comment on this episode or sign up to be a caller on a future episode. That's backstoryradio.org.
And while you're there, take a moment to help us out with our upcoming show on the history of political conventions. We'll be exploring their dangerous side and the times when they've actually threatened the status quo.
Know any great convention stories? Tell us about it. Our email address is backstory@virginia.edu.
You'll also find us on Facebook and Tumblr. We tweet at Backstory Radio.
Thanks for listening. We'll be back again next week. In the meantime, don't be a stranger.
Today's episode of Backstory was produced by Neil Beschenstein, Jess Angabretson, Eric Mennel, and Allison Quantz. Jamal Milner is our technical director. Our senior producer is Tony Field.
We had help from Alan Chen. Frank Cirillo is our intern. Backstory's executive producer is Andrew Windham.
Special thanks today to Sean Michelle Smith and our voiceover actors, Matthew Gibson and Davis Salisbury.
Major support for Backstory is provided by the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation, the University of Virginia, Weinstein Properties, an anonymous donor, and the History Channel, history made every day.
Peter Onuf and Brian Ballow are professors in the University of Virginia's Corcoran Department of History. Ed Ayers is president and professor of history at the University of Richmond. Backstory was created by Andrew Windham for the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities.